we now know in development what works or not based on 20 years of evidence. And AI has the ability for us to unlock those learnings and apply them.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. AI has become an essential tool in the social sector. It promises improved efficiency, increased personalization, and reduced costs. But how do we ensure it's used wisely, that it really does improve people's lives and it doesn't monopolize increasingly scarce resources? Project AI Evidence at the Abdul Latif Jameel Poverty Action Lab, JPAL, of course, has created an AI evidence playbook. It claims to be a practical guide for policymakers, practitioners, and donors. Iqbal Dhaliwal is the Global Executive Director of JPAL. He's also one of the authors. He joins me now. Iqbal, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks, Tim. Great to be with you.
Iqbal, in advanced economies, we can't get through a conversation without hearing about how AI is changing the way we're working and living. Is there an equivalent energy around AI in developing countries?
Yes, absolutely. Although I would say that it varies from country to country, but overall, I do feel that AI has created a buzz in the lives of the people and in the work of just about every organization, including in the development space, which is quite unprecedented. Even organizations which are not currently or actively using AI are definitely asking themselves the question, how is this technology going to impact the people that I serve? How is this technology affecting the way I serve those people? And how does all of that fit into the way that the society itself is going to change because of AI? So yes, definitely the buzz is there, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of trepidation as well, but definitely a huge amount of awareness.
The policymakers and practitioners that this is drawing in, why do you think they needed a playbook?
For me personally, this was a very fun project because I got to wear both my hats, my current hat as the CEO of JPAL, where we think a lot about what is the impact of development programs and policies. Are they really having an impact on the lives of the people, on learning outcomes, health outcomes as intended, or are they just merely a lot of additional work and cost? But also wearing my old hat, in my previous life, I used to be a civil servant in the Indian government, and we were facing exactly these sort of dilemmas. Where should we invest our money? Which programs work or not? What will I be able to show to my bosses, who are the politically elected ministers, as well as to the people whom I serve, about what change have I made in the 2 or 3 years that I had. So this playbook was for a way to say, how should policymakers, how should donors, how should implementers, how should anybody in the development space be thinking about AI adoption in a time when there is increasing pressure from shareholders or from board of directors or from the people or from your ministers to show that you're using AI. So the playbook is an attempt to help you figure your way out.
This is very early stage technology. All the applications of it are fresh. Do we have enough evidence at the moment to be able to draw useful conclusions?
So yes and no, like a good economist. I think yes for two reasons. First of all, if you think about AI as a standalone technology, then of course we don't have enough evidence just because the AI itself has evolved rather rapidly in the last 2 years in general usage. And also there's not enough evaluations to get to that impact. But then if you think about AI not as an end in itself, but as an enabler of achieving improved health outcomes or educational outcomes or improved farmer productivity, then we have more than 25, 30 years of evidence now from development programs and randomized control programs about what works or does not work in the field to improve those outcomes. And AI, when it fits into that broader milieu of what is working or not, has a lot of evidence to rely on. And so this is exactly part of our hope in this event, in writing this playbook, is that do we want to start from zero, think of AI as the end in itself, or do we want to think of AI as a means to an end? And then we definitely know. We know what's the best ways to get children to come to school. Once these children come to school, how do we keep them in school? If we keep them in school, we know that's not enough because they may still not be learning. And now we know from 15, 20 years of evidence, what are the best ways for them to learn in school? So if we step on that existing evidence to then integrate AI, then yes, we have plenty of good evidence about at least start thinking about how to incorporate AI in development.
So J-PAL, you have always been very strong advocates using randomized controlled trials as rigorous evidence for what works. That's a slow, it's a very careful method. Is it appropriate to assess the effectiveness of a technology that is literally evolving week by week at the moment?
Yeah, it's a great question and one that I get asked very, very often. I think the first thing to remember is that the speed of the evaluation or the randomized control trial is driven by your own theory of change. If you bring in a new teacher into the school, if you change the curriculum, if you reassign children based on their learning levels rather than their grade level, what's your hypothesis as a teacher or as an education specialist as to how many weeks, months, or year does it take for that underlying program to show impact? So I think the first fallacy that people have is that the randomized control trial is a slowing kind of a mechanism. It's not. It's piggybacking on your own theory of change. On the other hand, if the only thing that you care about is I'm going to add three more teachers in the class, and because of that, 1 month later, what's going to be the impact on student happiness? The RCT will give you the result in exactly 1 month. It does not have to wait for 1 year. So I think that's part number one. The second thing, Tim, actually, is that I think AI is creating tools and providing data which might even help speed up the way the evaluations happen. Because AI, by its very nature, is collecting data digitally. And not just sometimes on the treatment group, but oftentimes on the control group as well, because they are part of the whole bigger milieu of administrative and other data sets. And so I think we actually have an opportunity to design evaluations very quickly, see how their impact is, and get the results out in front of people. Something I'm also very excited about is that AI is helping us in the research process itself. It's helping us in collecting these surveys. Open-ended queries can now be tagged much more easily using AI. We can use AI for data cleaning. We can use AI for a fair amount of data analysis. So AI itself is helping speed up the research process.
Now, in reading the playbook, it's not really about the technology of AI very much, apart from what you really have to describe. It's about how you can usefully apply it. And you've identified what, 6 pathways for applying AI. What pathways did you identify here?
We looked at the evidence from the development space in the last, again, 15, 20 years to say, what are the areas where we feel AI can do two of the things that you described earlier, increase impact or reduce costs? And based on that, we were able to classify most of the evidence in these 6 big buckets. The first is around improving needs prediction and targeting. Mm-hmm. So think about who are the poor and how should you increase the targeting to the poor. The second was increasing access to personalized, timely support. So you think about it again, you're a farmer, you need to know what exactly are the diseases blighting your leaves. I can give you that access to that personalized information. The third is maximizing the effectiveness of frontline service providers. These are our teachers, our primary health center workers. And once again, think about how we can improve the health diagnosis on the front lines. The fourth one is about improving the efficiency of the entire organization itself. An example here is the court systems, the legal systems in developing countries, where basic court transcription can take days, if not weeks, And if that process can be speeded up, you can improve the entire efficiency of the legal system. The fifth one is about reducing bias and ensuring fairness. You know, a lot of times the questions I get asked is, how do you make sure that the AI is not adding biases? And I'm like, you know, I can remove the biases in AI through three lines of recoding, but the biases that have been built into my brain over thousands and thousands of years of civilization, those are the harder ones to get at. And I think AI can do that. And the sixth and the final channel that we talk about and which we are very excited about is boosting resources for governments, especially in low and middle income countries, through better targeting of the programs, but more importantly, making the entire tax system itself more progressive. So those were the six channels that we feel most useful for AI investments.
There are some very interesting applications in there, and you go into quite a lot of detail about what has already been tried and what has been working well, and sometimes where people have come up against challenges. One of the challenges you come up against with things like personalization and reducing bias is we know a lot about some people in the population. Very often the people we most want to help are the people we know least about. There is least digital information on them. How can we solve that problem?
Yeah, the first and the foremost thing that AI cannot solve for us is the lack of good data. Irrespective of how good AI becomes, we have to strengthen the data and administrative data systems and the data collection in low and middle income countries exactly for the reasons that you described. Now, what AI can do is it can help fill in these gaps. So for instance, during the COVID crisis, the nation of Togo really wanted to strengthen the social protection program for its people, but it found out that there were big gaps and holes in its identification of what you just described. Who are the poor and where do they live? And so that's where our researchers were able to use machine learning tools. They use satellite images to identify which are the neighborhoods which are likely to be poor. And you can do that by identifying things like the square footage of the house, the type quality of the roof. Are there any cars standing in the driveway? Are there air conditioners put on the walls? Like, those are the sort of things that can give you a lot of information about which are the neighborhoods which may be richer or poorer. And then if you pair that with information from mobile phones, the amount of usage, the call time, and so forth, then you're able to narrow down within those neighborhoods, where do the poorer people live? So I think that's a great example where AI can augment the existing administrative and other databases and really help improve the prediction. I think the second frontier on this prediction and targeting part is the targeting bit. In development, we have used these blunt tools to find out who are all the people below the poverty line, and let's give them a loan to make them entrepreneurs. Now, it might be that everybody is not well suited to entrepreneurship. It requires a particular type of mindset. It requires being more comfortable with risk, and everybody may not be comfortable with that. Once again, AI tools can help improve the targeting and make sure you are providing the right program to the people who are most likely to run with that program and be successful.
Might AI be a very timely technology at the moment? A lot of what you're describing here involves doing more with less, and the challenges never go away, but a lot of the support, the aid support that has traditionally helped to deliver these programs, well, that is going away.
You're absolutely right. I think it could not be more timely, but I would add to those points. So the first point I first fully support, with the destruction of the US aid and the holes that that created, plus the huge fiscal tightening, which is happening both in the advanced economies and the poorer economies. In advanced economies, it is happening because of their own requirements, needs for diverting resources to, let's say, the Ukrainian rebuilding. But in the poorer countries, many of the poorer countries still haven't recovered from the fiscal shocks of the COVID spending. So they are looking for solutions which are cost-effective, solutions which can help improve the reach of the state. And I think this is where AI can be extremely helpful. Think about agricultural extension workers. A good agricultural extension worker who can go to rural farms in Ghana or Kenya and tell the farmers, this is the disease that is blighting your crop. This is exactly the solution for that, and customize that, is extremely valuable. But that agriculture extension worker is extremely hard to find, to train, to supervise, and then to retain. And as a result, we have a huge shortage of agricultural extension workers. And now think about an app. A farmer can simply take a photograph of a blighted leaf, upload it, and within seconds, based on the actual, I won't use the word zip code, but the exact latitude and longitude of where they are, the soil type, the local weather conditions, get immediate and a very accurate diagnosis of what the problem is. And so that's the sort of thing that is so timely, both because of the financial crunch, which doesn't allow us to hire more ag extension workers, but it's also very timely because we now know in development what works or not based on 20 years of evidence. And AI has the ability for us to unlock those learnings and apply them. So that's the positive thing, right, Tim? So that's what gives us excitement. Mm-hmm. But I think what the playbook is all about is that this excitement, it will not automatically translate to the effect that I just told you on the ground in terms of farmers' income or productivity. There are issues around the trust in technology. Will the farmer have access to these devices and the connectivity? And so I really hope that we can focus as much on plumbing behind the scenes things as much as on the shiny apps in the front.
What will it take to create that credibility for these applications of AI, both for, in that example, the agriculture extension worker who you would want to be able to use the advice that it's delivering, and the farmer who you would hope would believe it?
The most important thing I tell especially app developers and governments is design for impact and design for scale. I think a lot of the focus right now ends up being on creating a product which looks shiny, which looks interesting, a product which is measured in the lab, or when we experimented with 100 people, it was very positively received. We care a lot about downloads and engagement numbers. So that is great, but that's just the first step. If you're not measuring the true impact of this app on the lives of the people, on the health outcomes, then this app will not succeed. And designing for scale has multiple challenges, right? Like, it means designing for a farmer who may not have a device. Even if the farmer gets the device, they may not have 24/7 internet connectivity. Even if they have both of those, how will they trust the underlying technology without an ag extension worker? The reason I trusted Tim's advice is because Tim was coming to my farm for the last 15 years. And now this app, why should I trust that? So I think those back-end things are really important to succeed both in the ag extension worker case and beyond.
We talk a lot about the problems of designing for scale in the analog world at delivering programs that have looked good in trials, but yet they are very hard to deliver at a regional or a national level. Are those problems the same? Does AI inherit those problems?
It absolutely inherits those problems. And I would say those problems are exacerbated. To your point about inheritance, yes, if the government or the local NGO does not have the technical capacity to scale the program with fidelity, to understand what's the main theory of change based on which this program and the levers are going to succeed, then this program will fail. And we see that over and over again, right? We see this in this one laptop per child. We see this in the smokeless stoves, which are supposed to be like these panaceas of all the problem. But think about the one laptop per child. It didn't fail because the underlying theory of change was not wrong, but we just didn't figure out how will the existing school system incorporate this laptop in a system where they barely get electricity or internet connection? What are the apps required to be downloaded on those computers to make it successful? How will you make sure that the children have time to engage with those apps and are not being distracted by other things? What happens if a laptop breaks down? Is there a mechanism to get it repaired and back in the hands of the children in real time? All of those things, if you don't think about, then the technology fails. So that's your inherited problems. The exacerbated problems are because the technology is so new, because the technology is changing so fast, it's hitting against the limits of people's capacity to incorporate it, their capacity to innovate with it, and the physical infrastructure challenges that I talked to about earlier. And so I think we have to be even more careful with AI than with past technologies about making sure that it's incorporated properly.
it seems very important at the beginning to ask those detailed questions. I guess everyone thinks they've got a theory of change right up until the time that someone interrogates them closely about it.
Absolutely. What is fun about the theory of change, or at least my learning has been over the last 15 years talking to them, is exactly what you summarized. Everybody thinks they have a theory of change, but once you actually start putting it on a piece of paper, oftentimes you realize that what they have is a very optimistic hypothesis without having thought about the middle pieces of that theory of change. So the way a theory of change goes is, you have some inputs. Let's say you're going to give a laptop, and then that laptop is going to be used by the children. That will then lead to an improvement in their learning outcomes. What it misses out is all these intermediary links in between. How will you convince the children to use these laptops? How will you convince the teachers to use these laptops? At what time of the day should this laptop be incorporated into the existing school system? And if you haven't thought that through, then it's very heroic to assume that those inputs will lead to the final outcome.
So I want to ask you a couple of questions about how we translate the language and the thinking of the tech business into the sorts of challenges that you face, because they are very different worlds. One of the things that we think about, this competition that we have for models. At the moment, everyone's saying, well, look at this model, this does this much and it outpaces the other model and it's better at this. If we think too much about that, does that take away from thinking about all the things that you're describing, access to the technology, adoption of the technology?
100%. I always say, use the least possible technology that gets you to your outcome. For instance, if all that it is required is to provide some information, and that information can be provided either by somebody calling you in or sending a text message, then you don't need to create a very fancy AI, you know, Jiran tool to give you super customized information, because all the information you're giving it is the tax deadline is day after tomorrow. You don't need AI to help me get that message any better. The second part is that the always see the AI underlying LLM as a tool rather than as end itself. We should not be trying to do an evaluation of whether Gemini works better than Claude or not. In a sense, that's almost secondary. What I want to know is, how does AI allow a teacher in the classroom to reassign their time from rote activities like grading question papers to more creative things like sitting with children, giving them customized feedback on their exams or on how they performed in the classroom? The first is almost a trivial problem. I think either Gemini or Claude should be able to grade a test. And it's a simple model evaluation of which one does it slightly better than the other. But the second part is supremely complicated. You have to train the teachers in a different way of thinking about the classroom. You have to find time about redoing the timetable. Redoing a timetable in a school system is one of the toughest things possible. And that's where we don't pay enough attention. And instead, the whole attention ends up being Claude versus Gemini. That's not what is going to drive the success or the failure of the AI, but how the timetable got rechanged to incorporate AI into your day-to-day schedule. That's going to be the biggest driver of whether AI works.
Something that has also got in the way of implementing programs at scale has been the idea of taking account of context. In the tech business, universality is a really huge driver of adoption. The cloud is the cloud. Tech applications are the same all over the world. It sounds from what you're saying that the applications of AI for development really need to take account of the local conditions.
Exactly the way it is true for everything in development. Mm-hmm. You know, what we call global knowledge with the local context. I don't want to underemphasize the importance of local context, but I also don't want us to fall in this trap, which oftentimes I hear people will say, oh, this is wonderful to hear that this program worked in India, but I don't think it's going to work in Ghana. And then I'm like, take me through why it would not work in Ghana. And I think separating out basic rules and procedures from the underlying theory of change is very important. If you tell me it will not work in Ghana because the classroom is already 1:20 instead of 1:60, then that's a real difference. But the reason it won't work in Ghana is because currently the teachers are only required to show up for 6 hours of work, and this requires 6 hours and 15 minutes of work. That's not a context problem. That is a rule problem that is overcomable. What is important is that in both Ghana and in India, the reason that a lot of children are falling back is because the curriculum, the syllabus, is geared to the top of the class and it does not slow down for the others to catch up. That is a problem. Yes, if that is different across the two contexts, I worry about it. But otherwise, the general knowledge that is coming from India is equally relevant in Ghana. So I think, Tim, the context is very important, but also learning from different contexts can be actually very valuable.
Tech companies and the innovators within tech companies, when I speak to them, they are very comfortable. They enjoy the idea of learning through failure as the heart of innovation. A phrase that Facebook used to use about moving fast and break things. Well, in development, breaking things has a very high price. How can policy to innovate around AI manage or minimize the risk of failure for applications of AI and still get its benefits?
I think the first thing to do is to make sure that the models that you are adopting in your area are based on good training data to your earlier point that is contextualized for the place that it is built upon, that the model is based on technology and hardware that is sustainable in your local context. For instance, is your model based on every student getting a device in their hand, or can the devices be shared? Does it require 24/7 electricity and connectivity, or can it be operated on batteries and an offline mode? Just asking those first questions will reduce the chances of failure. Mm-hmm. Having done that, I think it's really important to do quick, short, small-scale pilots of these various models and these various technologies to understand not just how AI is working against a non-AI model, but increasingly, a lot of people have access to the general AI tools. So you also want to make sure that these extra AI layers, these tools that you're building, are working better than what the real world is. And do it in small scale, in quick iterative evaluations before announcing a large scale program adoption. I always find it very worrying when countries or NGOs announce, starting in 2 months from now, we are going to roll out a program to the entire population. I think if you can avoid that and just be a little bit patient in this process, we can avoid exactly the worries that you have.
It's a very, very interesting document to read, and I'm sure it's going to be extremely useful. And I look forward to seeing how it's going to evolve. It is a sort of living document, isn't it?
It is. And I think it's been even more important for us to have this as a living document. As we talked earlier, a majority of this document is right now about the promise of AI, mapped to the existing evidence on where that AI is most likely going to be impactful. I would be very happy through evaluations to know that we were right in half, or right even in less than half of those cases, because it means that we are testing and we are trying to be honest to ourselves about where the promise of AI is real and where is its hype.
Well, it's an exciting document now. I'm sure it's going to be a very different document in 5 years' time. Thank you very much for talking about it, Iqbal.
Thanks, Tim. It was great talking to you.
The playbook is called the AI Evidence Playbook, a practical guide. It's downloadable from JPL. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. Our authors, Iqbal Dhaliwal, Sam Carter, Atullah Abbasi, and Audrey Lorvo. This has been a VoxDev Talk. Best way to make sure you never miss an episode, follow us. You find us wherever you get your podcasts, so then you get every episode as it comes out. All our past episodes are at voxdev.org, where there are articles about the topics we feature. If you like what you've been hearing, please tell someone else about us and leave us a review as well. VoxDev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zalgarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at VoxDev.